Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Elizabeth Berg, who reads from and discusses her new book, We Are All Welcome Here, published by Random House. In the weeks to come, we have Francine Matthews, John Berendt, James McGreevy, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Thank you so much for coming and for supporting our events, and thank you for supporting independent bookstores. Tonight it is my pleasure to introduce New York Times best-selling author Elizabeth Berg, who will talk about her new novel, We Are All Welcome Here. Elizabeth's characters are real people, people we can identify with. In her new novel, which is based on a one-woman story, three women are struggling against overwhelming odds for different kinds of freedom. It's 1964 in Tupelo, Mississippi. Civil rights demonstrations are taking a critical turn. Paige Dunn is trying to raise her adolescent daughter, Diana, and to give her a normal life with the help of PC, a rather tough caregiver. The novel focuses on Paige's health struggles after living through polio, Diana's adventures, and the troubled times of 1964. Once again, Elizabeth has written a wonderful story sure to resonate with every reader. Elizabeth has also written other best-selling novels, including The Year of Pleasures, Art of Mending, Say When, True to Form, Never Change, and Open House, which was an Oprah's Book Club selection in 2000. Durable Goods and Joy School were selected as the ALA Best Books of the Year, and in 1997, Elizabeth won the New England Booksellers Award for her body of work. She's also written nonfiction, including Escaping into the Open, The Art of Writing True. She lives in Chicago. Please welcome Elizabeth Berg.
Oh, hello. Thank you so much for coming out. I'm always worried, you know, what's on TV. And I'm not going to say what I saw tonight, because the other night I was at a reading and I said, isn't American Idol on tonight, the last one or something? It wasn't, actually, but I thought it was. And two people in the back looked at each other and got up and left. So I don't think I'll mention any specific things going on. I'm in the middle of a really long tour, and I think this is the 26th reading, and there are six or seven more to go. And I'll tell you how you know when you're getting tired. I went to a restaurant and sat down and looked for the seat belt. And you know how they... Now, you guys might not know this, but preparation age is good for bags under your eyes. So I started to brush my teeth with it. So I think I need to go home pretty soon. I'd like to read a little bit from the book, and then I'm happy to take any questions you have about it or anything, for that matter. And I don't read from just one place. I read a little bit here and a little bit there. And that way, if you doze off, no problem. You can join right in at the next reading. I want to say, too, that it is such a privilege to read at this beautiful bookstore. It is just every author loves to come here. It just, we kind of have our little favorite places, and we say, gone to the Tattered Cover. So when you get to answer yes, well, then that's pretty swell. How many of you here got the newsletter? A few. You're welcome. I'm glad you do. Did you try that recipe? Not yet. You're only supposed to have one piece if you want to adhere to the ha ha ha. I had four, but anyway, I do send out a newsletter annually, and it began because people would say, why didn't you tell me you were going to go, you know, wherever I went? So I began sending out a tour schedule, and as long as I was sending a tour schedule, I thought I'd send a letter, like I'd write to a friend, and as long as I was sending a letter, I had to send a recipe, because that's all we talk about, my friends and I. So if you would like to sign up for that, you get a tour schedule that will look like this, and, well, except it will be a different book, and a letter with a real first-class stamp, because I don't know about you, but Ed McMahon doesn't even write to me anymore, so it's kind of nice to get a letter. But if you want to sign up, I just need your name and address printed clearly, please, in this book, which beautiful Lisa, where is she? She's right there. Two beautiful Lisas. The other beautiful Lisa. Anyway, she'll have it, and she will just have it open to the page so you can sign. Okay, so I'm gonna start very near the beginning of the book, which was, as you heard, inspired by a true story. In 1951, when she was 22 years old and 9 months pregnant with me, my mother contracted polio and was for a time put into an iron lung. I was born there, my dubious claim to fame, pulled out through a bedpan portal, alive and howling, much to the amazement of the doctor, who had prepared death certificates in advance for both me and my mother. No woman had ever delivered inside a lung, but my mother had been too ill to be taken out of it. As soon as she saw me, wrapped in a white hospital blanket, my hand, my mother insisted, reaching toward her, she rose to joy. Not so for my father, who left when he learned my mother would not fully recover, that her only progress would be to move to a portable respirator. On his last visit to my mother, he told her that he would take care of getting me adopted out. My mother refused. She made arrangements to rent a house and hire a caretaker for me, and then she stayed in the lung for 3 years, driven to survive, so that she could come home and raise her daughter as well as any other mother, or better. She and I lived in a two-bedroom mill house just north of downtown Tupelo, Mississippi. You know the town, Elvis's birthplace. He had a kind of great luck and then terrible tragedy. For us, it was the opposite. This next part takes place, it's 1964. The narrator is Diana, who is the daughter, who's 13 years old, and she is living in poverty with the mother you just heard describe. And she doesn't have very many friends, but she finally found one, whose name is Suralee, and she's talking about her here. Suralee did not get along with other kids. They could not see her charms, but I did. Her very name, her double-jointedness, her new-from-the-box saddle shoes with their bubblegum-colored soles, her natural curls, the way my mother called her overly mature, her wild black dog named Shooter, her artistic ability, the cut-out photos of movie stars she kept on her walls. Most admirable was her skill at playing every one of her parts in our mini plays with total sincerity. I believed she was a bus driver, a distraught mother, a dead person, a movie star, Jesus of Nazareth. She imitated PC perfectly. I thought even PC liked it. I lay down and daydreamed, thought of how I might decorate under the porch just to get started. I could make it an office here, a place for Suralee and me to write our plays. After a while, I heard the screen door open and then PC saying, "Didn't I tell you to get out from under there?" I stayed silent. "Diana?" I held my breath. "I know you there, and I'm telling you for the last time to get out." She waited, then played her trump card. "And beside that, your mama want you." I scrambled out from under the porch and pushed past PC. "It's your mama wants you," I said. "And it's besides." "Says who?" PC asked. "Says me." "That ain't nobody. Wash your hands now. We're fixing to eat breakfast. You probably got the ringworm playing in the dirt like a dog. And no shoes as per usual. You wash up good. I made biscuits and my sister sent strawberry jam. Eat with them." "I want sausage gravy with them," I said. She stared at me. "You best wash out your ears, too. I ain't hear nobody say nothing about no sausage gravy." I went into the dining room, my mother's bedroom, to see what she wanted. PC had done her makeup well this morning. She was even wearing a little blue eyeshadow. "Bend down," she said, and when I did, she kissed my forehead. "Good morning." Her mouth smelled like Ipana. "Good morning," I said. "Scratch my left arm, will you, just above the elbow?" Although my mother could not move anything below her neck, she could feel everything. I scratched for her until she said, "Good." Then she said, "Are you making trouble already? Did I hear PC yelling at you?" "No, ma'am." She stared at me, a little smile on her face. My shoulders sagged. "Yes, but it was her fault." I backed up to sit at the foot of my mother's unmade bed. Later, I would have to make it, and God forbid there be a wrinkle anywhere when I was done. PC wanted the sheets pulled so firmly you could flip a coin off them. "Why do they have to be so tight?" I once asked. And PC said, "On account I said so, first and foremost. Nextly, it looked nice." She sniffed in her high and mighty way. "Crazy old fool," I muttered under my breath. "What'd you say?" she asked, and I said, "Nothing." "That's right," she said. "That's a sum total, your opinion." This goes back to 1951, on the day that the mother became ill with polio. They'd been going to have a picnic, my parents. They headed out northwest on Highway 78 for the open countryside and drove for many miles. My mother loved traveling, loved going away, but not on any planned trip. She liked to just spontaneously take off. As a child, adopted at age 6 from an orphanage in Oxford, she used to pack her cardboard suitcase with underpants and red licorice and then disappear into the fields behind her farmhouse. Or she would take off walking down the highway her family lived next to, driving her parents to distraction. At 15, she began running off with boys, returning all hours of the night. Finally, at 16, her exasperated parents threw her out of the house. They believed that this rash act would make her come to her senses. Instead, she cut off all contact with them, found a job in a Tupelo motel where she ended up living, and 2 years later married my father. When she became pregnant with me, she found that she wanted to reestablish contact with her mother, but her parents had moved, and she never found them again. On that July day, my mother pointed to a grassy bank under cottonwood trees, but before she was halfway through eating lunch, my mother began feeling ill and finally asked to be taken to the hospital. "Oh, baby, are you sure?" my father asked. They had no insurance, and they intended to have a home birth. Over and over he asked her if she was sure she needed to go to the hospital. She didn't answer him. She lay in the back seat of the car feeling worse all the time, and my father drove fast, then faster back toward Tupelo. By the time they got to a hospital, my mother could no longer walk. She was diagnosed immediately. She remembered the doctor taking one look at her and saying, "This woman has polio." And then she was put into an isolation room. When her breathing failed the next day, she was transferred to a larger facility and put into an iron lung. She talked very little about the time she spent there. Over the years, I'd learned bits and pieces of information, that there were many iron lungs all in one large room, and the only privacy was curtains that were sometimes drawn between them, that her iron lung was a mustard yellow color, and her neighbor's a muddy green. That one Christmas Eve, the patients had sung, with difficulty, of course, "O Holy Night," and it had made the staff cry. That the sound the bellows made with their rhythmic squeaks and thunks reminded my mother of windshield wipers. That when someone died, the patients' overhead mirrors would be turned so that they couldn't see the now silent iron lung being pushed past them. That my mother read 3 books at a time from her overhead rack so that the page turner wouldn't be needed so often. That the women patients wore their hair in top knots, necessary because of lying flat in the iron lung, and the style was called a polio poodle. That a psychiatrist once asked my mother, "How does it feel to realize your daughter will never know your touch?" To which my mother responded, how does it feel to be an incompetent asshole? That a patient once complained of feeling cold and his caregiver put a blanket over the lung rather than him. That the patients who couldn't talk made giddy-up sounds to call for help or click their teeth together or made a popping sound with their lips. That there was a ward newspaper to which my mother contributed poems and short stories. She learned in occupational therapy to write with a pen held in her mouth. It took an hour and 45 minutes for her to write one page. I asked once if people ever cried, and she hesitated, then said yes. Did you? I asked, and she said yes, but rarely. And only once had she cried hard and for a long time. It happened after she overheard a conversation between a doctor and a patient a few lungs down from her. The patient, whose name was Sam, asked, "So when will I go home, Doc? I want to drive my new car. I got a new convertible 2 days before I came in here." The doctor asked for a chair and pulled it up so Sam could see him eye to eye. Then he said, "I'm sorry, but I have to tell you that you won't be able to walk again or even breathe on your own." There was a long silence, and then Sam said, "What do you mean?" The doctor told him again, saying that the time for recovery had passed. Sam said, "Well, you're wrong. I'll drive to your house, and when I get there, I'll take you out for a ride." "I hope you will," the doctor said. "But Sam, I want you to start thinking about what it will mean if you can't." It was the night after that incident that my mother had sobbed, at least to the extent that she was able. She said it was more like high-pitched squeals, really, and that that had frustrated her as much as anything, that she couldn't even really have a good cry. But when she finished crying, she decided that if this were her fate, she would use all that she had left. "I could still taste and smell and hear and see," she said. "I could still learn and I could still teach. I could still love and be loved. I had my mind and my spirit, and I had you." This scene takes place when Diana has arrived home later than she should have. And Mrs. Gruder, who is their evening caretaker, is there. And her mother's friend, Brooke Robbins, had been there when Diana left. He's a man who knew her mother before she got polio, was in love with her then, and still is. "When I arrived home at 9:30, my mother was furious. 'Where were you?' she asked. She was seated at the kitchen table. Behind her, Mrs. Gruder dried the dishes with elaborate care, then noiselessly put them in the cupboard. 'Where's Brooks?' I asked. She wouldn't do much if he were there. 'Brooks has gone home,' she said. 'Answer me, where were you?' 'What?' I said. 'I was at Sir Ali's.' 'And how exactly was I supposed to know you were there?' 'Her mother called you,' I said. 'Her mother did not call me.' I sat at the table opposite her. 'Well, that's not my fault. She was supposed to.' 'It was your fault,' my mother said. 'You are responsible for you. If someone says they're going to do something for you, it's up to you to make sure they do it. I was worried about you. I had no idea where you were.' 'Well,' I said, 'you'd have to be pretty stupid not to figure it out.' 'Give me your finger,' my mother said. I stared at her. 'Give me your finger.' I put my left pointer up to her mouth, and she bit me. I drew in a quick breath, but did not cry out. 'Is the skin broken?' she asked. I looked. 'No.' 'Go wash it out anyway.' Mrs. Gruder, her face hanging low in sorrow, moved to help me, and my mother said, 'Eleanor, don't let her do it herself.' Mrs. Gruder watched as I washed my hands. I knew that she was in awe of the power my mother held over me. Sir Ali, too. More than once, Sir Ali had said, 'Why do you just let her bite you like that? Why do you put your finger there? What's she going to do if you walk away?' 'I don't know,' I always said. I really didn't. But my mother, who on that sad day in the iron lung and had vowed to use whatever power she had left, did exactly that with a vengeance. If she had told me to slap my own face, I would have." That's true, incidentally. the story that I was told about the real mother has largely been fictionalized, but that particular method of discipline was true. So the mother is shunned kind of by her community. She has really very few friends, and it is decided that she really ought to go out. And Brooks decides he's going to take her out to dinner, and after much discussion and with another friend to handle all the equipment and so on, they do take her out to dinner. Meanwhile, Surah Lee decides that Diana goes over to Surah Lee's house where they're having drinks, rum and coke, you know. So Diana experiments with this and comes home inebriated, thinking that her mother won't be home yet and she'll just go to bed, but her mother's home. So she's trying very hard to act normal and to steer the subject away from where she's been. And she says to her mother, "Did you have fun on your date?" My mother readjusted her head on the pillow. "No, I did not have fun. I was ridiculed and stared at, and then I was thrown out." "Why?" I felt dangerously close to tears, but oddly my sorrow was for me. "It seems the proprietor had no idea about the extent of my disability," my mother said. "At first he didn't say much. He just looked at me, you know, that look." I made a pulled-in kind of face, and my mother nodded. "Exactly," she said. "And then sometimes they do this," I said, and made a frankly horrified face, which made my mother smile. Maybe we were done with my sins and could move on to her humiliations. She said, "I'll tell you what happened next, Diana. Though I had my back to the rest of the room, as Brooks had promised, it seemed I was upsetting the other diners. They didn't like the noise of my respirator. They didn't like it that I had to be fed. One man came up to me on his way out. He said, 'What can you have been thinking to come out to a public restaurant this way?'" "What did you say?" I asked. "At first, nothing," my mother said. "My mouth was full. I kept chewing, and I just looked at him." "Well," he said. And then he said it again, louder. So I spit my food out at him. And then I said, "Sorry, my mouth was full. Now we can have a conversation." I saw the scene, some scowling man standing before my mother while his indignant wife waited by the door, holding tightly onto her purse, her jaw dropping after my mother spit food at her husband. "What did Brooks and Holt do?" I asked, giggling in a kind of loose way. "They escorted me out," my mother said, "because right after that I was told to leave and never to come back. But I will go back." "Why?" I said. "Why would you ever want to go back there?" Her respirator was on inspiration, but I could see the answer burning in her eyes. Then she said, "You know, it's so funny. What keeps any of those people in that dining room from being like me is just a virus, a thing in my body over which I had no control. Why did I get it and not them? Fate, circumstance, luck. But I have a place on the earth just as they do. I have rights. When I was in the lung, I had people tell me every day that I had to get used to the fact that I could never have a normal life. Every day, they told me I would have to come to terms with all I could no longer do. But I decided to concentrate on what I could do. When the shrink talked about how the disease would affect my personality, I talked about how my personality would affect the disease. I didn't understand why nobody... I kept thinking, I'm me. I'm still me. Her voice began to shake, and she closed her eyes, then opened them. "Wipe my tears away and give me a chocolate," she said. I put a tissue to her eyes and then lifted the box up so that she could see in. Man brought her a box of Whitman samplers, and Diana really wants the messenger boy. "Which one?" I asked. She surveyed the candies carefully. "The chocolate-covered cherry," I said. "The messenger boy," she said, and I gave it to her with regret. I put the box back down, hoping she would say around her mouthful of chocolate, "You take one too," but she didn't. She chewed slowly, and then, in a more deliberate tone, she began speaking again. "I promised myself that I would raise you, though everyone advised me against it. I promised myself I would pay attention to the world and keep on learning, maybe even go back to school someday, though I knew how hard it would be. I thought I might even get married again. Everyone said I shouldn't get my hopes up for that kind of relationship. And I've given up on that, but I learned tonight that I can at least go out. I can leave the house. It's scary, but I can do it. And maybe someday I will go back to school. I know I'll be looked at. I know it'll bother people to see me. I know most people would say I should stay home where it's easier for me and my caretakers. But what most people think isn't always the right thing. I sat still, hardly breathing. I had never heard my mother talk so much about this all at once. "All your life, Diana," she said, "you're going to run into situations where you have to decide whether or not to take a stand. Sometimes it just isn't worth it, but other times it is. Not only is it worth it, it's vital. It makes you the person that you are. You have to honor what you know is true, or bit by bit you die inside." She smiled. "So, now let's talk about your evening." I'm going to finish with a part that takes place when the mother has been hospitalized. She's quite seriously ill. And Diana has been brought to PC's house, where she's never been before. It's in Shagrag, which is the black part of Tupelo. And she's feeling really guilty about her mother being hospitalized, feeling that she had a big part to play in the reason that she was hospitalized. She's been lying on PC's sofa sobbing, but now she's gotten a grip on herself. "I went into PC's kitchen, smaller than our own, but with a nicer-looking refrigerator. PC sat at a square metal table playing solitaire. I sat opposite her and surveyed the cards. "Black 8 on the red 9," I said, pointing. "I know that," she said, and moved the card. Then she sat still, considering. I saw another move, but I kept my mouth shut. In a moment, she saw it, too. "Bet you's bustin' to tell me about that one, too." "I didn't see it," I said. "Lie like a rug." She leaned back in her chair and regarded me. "You about done with your own private wailing wall?" I nodded. "Then get back in there and wring out that sofa before it float away." I smiled at PC, grateful for her attempt at humor. Behind her at the window were some yellow curtains with little white polka dots tied back with matching bows. I recognized them as having been in a recent donation bag. "Are those from us?" I asked. PC looked behind her. "What, the curtains?" I nodded. "Y'all gave them to me. Y'all didn't want them." "They're pretty," I said. "You ain't taking them back. Ain't from you anyway. They from your mama." "I didn't say I wanted them. I just said they were pretty." She stood and pushed her chair in. "I see you coming and going, Diana Dunn." She was right. I did want the curtains back. When we'd given them to her, they were wrinkled and dirty, rag-like. Now they seemed cheerful and sweet. "You hungry?" PC asked. "No." "I believe I'll check in on your mama then." She was overly casual saying this. It made me worried. PC went to the wall phone and dialed a number, then straightened as she spoke into the mouthpiece. "Yes, I'm calling to inquire about a patient y'all have there, Miss Paige Dunn." "Yes, ma'am." She waited, her fingers drumming on the counter, then said, "Yes? Yes, ma'am, I am a relative. I'm her sister, Betty Dunn, calling from New Orleans. Calling long distance, so..." "Oh, really? When was that?" "All right, then, I'll try later." PC hung up the phone, went to the already clean sink, and started wiping at it. "What?" I said. "What, what?" She wouldn't turn around. "What did they say at the hospital?" "They say call back later, which I will do." "Why didn't you talk to my mother?" She didn't answer. "PC?" She turned around. "Now don't be carrying on. She went to the ICU. I swallowed, then stood up. "Let's go. I want to go there." PC came over to the table and pushed me gently back down into the chair. "Now look here at me. You know, the same as me, we can't go there. She gonna be fine. She in the best place she can be at. You know she do this sometime, get all sick, and then she come home fine as pie. Ain't nothing to it. If she's in the ICU, she's really sick. PC said, well, where you want her to be if she that sick? The ICU. ICU mean instant cure underway. That is exact and precise what it means. It means intensive care unit, I said, and half those people never come out. We stared at each other, and then miserable, I said, when are you calling back? PC thought for a moment, then said, can you be a doctor? What do you mean? I mean, can you call and act out, use a doctor, just like a play? Then they tell us how she is. I was seized by fear, but in a calm voice I answered, yes, I can do that. PC handed me the phone and began dialing the number again. But what do I say? I asked. She shrugged. You the doctor. When the hospital operator answered, I lowered my voice and identified myself as Dr. Holloway, then asked for the ICU. When a woman there answered, I said, yes, yes, I'm Dr. Holloway, calling to inquire about my patient, Paige Dunn. Yes, doctor? I leaned against the counter, frozen. How's she doing? PC said. Ask how's she doing. How is she doing? She's stable, doctor. Spiked a temp up to 104, but we've got her on a cooling blanket, and it's down to 101. She's a little tachycardic, but her pressure's back up, and the other vital signs are okay. Urine output's fine. Sputum results aren't back yet, of course. Of course, I said. And when do you expect she'll come home? There was a pause, and then the woman said, well, that will be up to you, of course. Did you say you were Dr. Holloway? I could hear her rifling through some pages. Are you on staff here? I hung up. Her temperature was high, but it came down, I told PC. She's on a cooling blanket. PC nodded. All right. That's good. We'll call back later, doctor. I don't want to be the doctor anymore, I said. You do it next time. She laughed. Dr. Holloway. Hey, doctor, I got a pain in my achilles heel. Can you fix it? So that will give you more than a taste of what's in here. Thanks. Thank you. So, any questions or comments? Complaints can be directed downstairs. Yes. I do have daughters, but they are, those characters don't come from them. My daughters are more mature than I. And I do remember a lot about what it was like to be that age. It's such a delicate and interesting and vulnerable and hard time of life. Yes. You mean, was it Durable Goods, the one where her mother's dead and her father is raising? I have written a lot of books, and as you know, I'm tired. wait a minute. Give me another hand. The mother's dying. I think you might be talking about Durable Goods because she talks, if it's one of my books, because she talks about her mother dying there, though when the book opens she has already died, but she flashes back.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. We're not going to have any more quizzes, are we? You know, I think that... for me, writing is a way of trying to understand things and come to terms with things and actualize things. It always has been. And if there's any wisdom in it, it doesn't come from me. It comes from whatever that process is. And I really do believe that the creative process, whether it's dance or art or writing, is magical. And who knows? You know, who knows where those things come from? It's really, if I were to try to stand up and talk about something or intellectually figure something out, it wouldn't happen. It comes from going deep inside and connecting to things that I'm not always in touch with, but I am when I write. Yeah. What? That's talk before sleep. It's okay, because the same themes resonate throughout all the books. So,
I know, it was very helpful, and I thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Yes, sir. Sure. I always wrote in journals, and I wrote letters, and I was the kid that, you know, when the English teacher said, now you're going to have a theme, and everybody groaned, I said, yes. And I got in trouble in science class in junior high, and my punishment was to write my autobiography. I mean, that was like locking me up in Fanny Farmer overnight, you know. I mean, so I always loved it, and I always did it in whatever form I could, but I didn't write stories or anything like that. And when my daughters were 4 and 9, I didn't like leaving them with babysitters when I went to work. So I was casting about for something I could do at home, and I was thinking, let's see, telemarketing. I thought maybe I'd make muffins and sell them at the L Stop, you know. And then I thought, well, maybe I'll be a writer. Like, maybe I'll buy a loaf of bread. And I really didn't know anything about it. But I went to the drugstore that day and bought a bunch of magazines. And my idea was that I would try to write personal essays, which, in fact, I did. I wrote for magazines for 10 years before I started writing books. And I first wrote nonfiction, and then I became interested in fiction and did some stories. And then the stories got longer. Incidentally, for those of you who may be interested, there's a magazine called Bark. Does anyone know it? It's kind of like the New Yorker for dog lovers. I did a story in there called The Only One of a Million Just Like Him that I really like, so read it. And it has a great photograph to illustrate it, too. Well, thank you. Thank you. It is kind of the same thing. I mean, it's been very rewarding to me to understand that that is true for some people. Yeah. I didn't. You know, I think that magazines aren't quite as easy to break into now as they were then. This was, you know, like 20 years ago. But I still think it's a good way to get started. Does he write fiction or nonfiction? There's a magazine called National Geographic Traveler, and I happen to know that the editor there, whose name is Keith Bellows, Bellows, is very much open to new writers. So if he has travel pieces, he might want to approach him. Otherwise, I would just tell him to go to the library and look at all the magazines that there are, or look at a writer's market and see all the different places where things can go. There are extensive lists, and I'm sure in this bookstore there's a big section of books on writing. So, yeah. I like to read. My favorite writer of all time is E.B. White, for his clarity and his humor and his politics. And I like Alice Munro, the short story, primarily short story writer. That's M-U-N-R-O, Alice Munro. Anne Tyler is one of my favorites. I like a lot of Southern writers. I like to read poetry. I like to read essays. I like to read science sometimes. I don't understand it, but it's so beautiful. I just like to read it. I bought a book once called Longing for the Harmonies, which it was not understandable, not one page, not one sentence, but I had to buy it because what a title. I like Richard Ford. Richard Bausch, who has written both short stories and novels, is a really brilliant writer. There's a guy named Mark Sluka, S-L-O-U-K-A, who wrote a book called Lost Lake that's one of the most beautiful things I ever read. Lost Lake, yeah. And Elizabeth Strout, you know. There's a lot of them. I need to make a list for when that question comes up. But never mind them. Let's just talk about me. Yes. Augustine Burroughs has mentioned me in my books, but I've never heard. Where was he? Oh, he did. See, I don't want to say anything to him because he might stop if I say anything. So I'm telling you all, but don't tell him I said anything. You're not planning on seeing him very soon, okay? Yes. No, no. What's true is that this woman sent me a letter saying that every time she described her childhood and her mother, people would say to her, you should write a book, but she doesn't write. And so she said, I'd really like you to do this. And she was looking for someone to do it in a nonfiction format. And I said, you know, well, first of all, I like to come up with my own ideas. And secondly, I don't want to tell your story. You should tell your story. You should write it, or you should work with a nonfiction writer. But she had sent a photograph, and I have a copy of it, which you probably won't be able to see very well now. But if afterwards you want to come up and look at it, I'll have it at the table. But it was this photo, which shows the mother is here wearing a portable ventilator. A lot of people were going past this the other night and saying, oh, so that's the iron lung. That's not the iron lung. This is an iron lung. And she was in that for 3 years. And you can see above the iron lung, she kept pictures of her children. And there's another photo that this one really killed me, of when her baby was just born. She's being shown her baby. She's in the lung, and the nurse is holding her baby up. Anyway, it was that first photo, this one, that she sent me, and I just was so captivated by the image and by the mother's face, and she's so well groomed, and she's not full of sorrow or self pity, and I was just inspired by the photo to try to explore a personality like that. So, but I really didn't know anything about her other than she had told me that her mother had disciplined her by biting her finger, and so I said I'll try this, but it's going to be fiction. It's not going to be your life. It's going to be fiction. And she was fine with that, and we had an email correspondence, and I would ask her questions, mostly technical questions about her mother's ability to be out of the ventilator, how did she speak at such times, and so on. And then when the book was finished, I met her after that. Yeah, and she's a very positive person. I think she got that from her mother. Really positive, can-do kind of person. Yes. I don't plot. I just let it happen every day. But I really, really trust the process. That's how it works best for me, is to give myself over. But everybody works different ways. You know, some writers do plot. Some writers, like Ann Patchett, I have heard, knows the whole book before she starts writing. And it's the opposite for me. I have a vague idea. I might start with a character. I might start with some sort of social issue I want to explore, or some sort of feeling, and then it tells me rather than the other way around. Yeah. That I don't like? Yeah. Yeah, that's hard. Yeah, these are likable. But there's a book called The Art of Mending that has some difficult characters in it, but it was a very important issue for me, and I really wanted to write that book. But it was hard. It's hard. This one, you know, it was kind of joyful to go show up at the office every day and see what PC was going to do, because she was a character who just showed up fully formed. I was lying in bed where I do some of my best thinking, and the sentence, "Here comes PC walking down the sidewalk swinging her big black purse," and I said, okay, but the name PC? And she said, that's my name. So I said, okay. So there's a book called The Pull of the Moon that has a character called Nan, and she too was just showed up fully formed, and it's just so easy because they just push you around, tell you what to do. You know? Yeah. Yes, in real life, she was 9 months pregnant and 22 years old when she got polio, and she had three children age 6 and under, and her husband did abandon her and said, I'm such a swell guy, I'll adopt the kids out, and she said, oh no, you won't. And she, the kids went first to relatives and then to foster homes for 3 years until she came home. And then she didn't have caretakers like the woman in my book. She relied quite literally on the kindness of strangers. So, yeah. And after having been away from school for 30 years, went back and got a degree and became a substance abuse counselor. And always wore lipstick. She always had her lipstick on. Anyone else? Yeah. There is another book. It will be out in November, November 7th. I was very interested in the character of Joseph, you know. So I wrote a book kind of like When Harry Met Sally, but it's When Mary Met Joseph. And it sort of humanizes the first Christmas. Yeah. It's the first Christmas, you know. It's her meeting him. She was very young, of course, and their relationship and her having to tell him, Joseph, maybe you should sit down. You know, just have to tell you about, no, really, it was an angel. It really was. And I did a lot of research for this book, and it was really interesting, and I really like it. I have to say, it's a Christmas book, so it has a. It's a smaller format and a really pretty cover, and they did the chapter headings in beautiful illustrated ways, and it's really nice.
So,
it's called The Handmaid and the Carpenter. Yeah. Yeah, I expect so. You know, I know Dan Brown and I like him very much and I'm really happy for him, but enough already, you know. It's enough. You can't even find a book, you know. I was looking for a book in the airport. You have to slog through all the Da Vinci Code and the Da Vinci Code wannabes and the Da Vinci Code cookout, workout, you know, devotional. It's ridiculous. I mean, I haven't talked to him, but I wonder if even he is saying, Jesus. Stop, yeah. Yeah, but I guess he doesn't have to write another book now, does he? Who'd have thunk it? You know what? Do you know the story of Dan Brown that when he turned in the book, they thought, you know, he might sell some copies. And they started getting kind of excited because there was a little buzz. And they told him, you know, you might debut on the New York Times list. And then they said, you might debut in the top 10. And then when he was at a hotel, he was out on a book tour, he received a fax, with the number one. Isn't that cool? I love that story. And now, you know, I mean, how much good news can one person take? This is an interesting question. Does anything thrill him anymore about this book, is what I wonder. I have a friend who's a very famous writer, and she said, oh, I remember when I used to get excited. This doesn't happen anymore. Yeah. Have I read it? No, I have not. I am the only person. This is my fame. Oh, you haven't? Okay. Okay. All right. We're going to stay together. Somebody has to not read it. Okay. If there are no more questions? Okay. I want to thank you again so much for coming out.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Francine Matthews, John Berendt, James McGreevy, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on May 22nd, 2006.